It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 602 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I have a great discussion with Frankie B. Washington, one of the creators of Kaijus and Cowboys, which has a Kickstarter campaign coming soon. The book is described this way. Matthew Blair and Frankie B. Washington have partnered to launch Kaijus and Cowboys, a 22-page sci-fi western monster comic and 12-issue series set on an alien world in a far-off future. It focuses on a hunter bot tasked with fighting monsters and preventing humans from colonizing a planet. We talk about how the series came to be, how successful it has already been in crowdfunding, delve into the characters, and talk about how creative the writing and art is in this landmark comic. This crowdfunding campaign is expected to launch on Monday, August 21, so be sure to support it once it begins. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what Frankie has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Frankie B. Washington, one of the creators of a really fascinating series called Kaijus and Cowboys. How's it going, Frankie?
Oh, it's going pretty good. We're ready. We're prepping. We're prepping for our next campaign, which is this Monday, August 21st, issue 3 of Kaijus and Cowboys. We've been working on this delightful comic book series for 3 years.
Wow.
Well, 3 years.
Well, all right. Well, let me read a little of the description, because I think this is something to help people understand. It's an homage to the Bronze Age of monster comics.
Yes.
The overall story arc deals with the last remnants of humanity aboard a gigantic space ark controlled by an AI called Father Mind. While humans sleep, the chosen planet is being terraformed by groups of robots. Unfortunately for the bots, the planet is infested by kaiju and daikaiju, I guess it's pronounced.
Yes.
That constantly rampage through the various settlement, towns, cities, destroying everything in their path. Enter the Hunter Bot, one of many specially designed robots programmed to fight and kill these monsters. The question is, who is right and who is wrong in this tale of colonization? Oh. Now, is this your fourth one? Fourth Kickstarter?
Yes, this is our fourth. Well, this will be our third Kickstarter, but we did try Zoop. Last year, we did issue one. We did issue one on Zoop.
Okay.
Matthew, my co-creator, and he's the writer, we decided to try to mix it up. He said, hey, Frank, let's try Zoop and see how that goes. It was an interesting experience because our first campaign was for our teaser issue, which was issue 0, which is available for free on digital on Global Comics right now. Mm-hmm. And it's just a teaser. You know, we sort of treated the series, which is going to be a 12-issue series. We're treating it sort of like you almost like if you're watching an animated show, whereas, you know, you have your trailer. You have a trailer to sort of, you know, introduce people really quick to what this is. And then they get excited for it. And then you go right into the actual show. And so the issue 0 was one that we did back in 2021, and we were on Kickstarter for that one. It was very successful. It blew our minds. Like, it was like, wow, people are really interested in this and stuff. And so what happened was in 2022, Matthew came with a suggestion. He said, hey, Frank, you know, he said, maybe we should try this new thing called Zoop. And so we decided to try Zoop. But unfortunately, you know, we were on Zoop and we learned some things about Zoop. Whereas I feel like Zoop is a very strong platform for those people who have already had like a massive sort of following. Ideally for people who have worked in the industry, mainstream, and who have a following. So then I think you do very well there. We were successful on it, but it was a struggle. It was a very struggle for us to get to the mark that we needed to get to, but we got there. So then afterwards we just said, hey, you know, why try to reinvent the wheel? Let's go back to Kickstarter. And that's what we did this year. So this will be our second campaign, Kickstarter campaign this year. So we had one in April. Yeah, we had one in April in which we end up doing issues. We did issue one as a catch-up tier, excuse me. And then it was for issue two. So then issue two was actually the campaign for April. But then we, you know, people wanted to catch up because they were like, oh, my God, wait, you know, how can we get this book and stuff? So we did a catch-up tier for issue one to go alongside issue two. And then that turned out to be quite successful. And then now here we are for August. And that's going to be for issue three. And then people can catch up for issues one and two as well on this campaign that's coming up.
Okay, well, so you said you've been working on this for how long?
3 years.
3 years, wow. Well, let's go back to the beginning and talk about how this all came to be. You're more the artist, you're a co-creator, but the artist mostly?
Yes, and marketer and promotions. I would say that my background, first off, I'm a commercial illustrator, and I've worked in the art industry for over 30 plus years. Off and on, I've done some comic book stuff, but mostly I've done some film stuff, worked in film, I've worked in animation, but a vast majority of my work that I did was as a commercial illustrator in advertising. And so I've learned a lot of the little nuances of promotion and marketing and stuff like that. But there was always this part of me that still hungered for comics. I mean, I love comics, even in those fields of like working in animation as well as film production. And then even advertising, I also had the chance to work on sequential artwork, which was storyboards. And in my mind, storyboards are just, you know, comic books are still in that sort of framework of storyboards. Mm-hmm. They're just more like but they have more panels and stuff like that. And you could do more interesting things with them. And so I've always, you know, I was like, man, I still want to get back in there. So off and on over the years, even though I was working in these different other avenues of the art industry, I would occasionally jump back and forth into little projects. Like if somebody was looking for someone to do artwork in an anthology, I'd raise my hand, you know, in between jobs. I'd be like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm doing this advertising gig over here. But, you know, hey, I'll do this little, you know, comic book story, whatever. And, you know, if you need the artwork or whatever. So I would do that. And so I would say, you know, off and on, I met Matthew. Me and Matthew, now our relationship, boy, I want to say we're almost on 7 years of knowing one another. And working with one another, because we started off working on a web comic series, which lasted for 5 years. And that was called The Secret Lives of Villains. And that was a web series. And what happened was COVID came in. I guess me and Matthew, we started talking. So I said, that's probably like in 2020, maybe. And which Matthew said, hey, Frank, just out of the blue, he was like, hey, you know, it'd be kind of cool to do like a Kaji story. Like he wanted to do a story that would be for me, because he knew that that's a thing. Like for me as a kid, I grew up watching, Creature Double Feature, watching Godzilla, Gamera. One of the books that inspired me the most was The Shogun Warriors by Marvel Comics. You know, I got a chance to meet Herb Trimpe before he passed away. I met him a few times, got to talk to him a lot, just to let him know how much that book impacted me. It was just this amazing, you know, just to see that in the Western comic book, stuff that I really liked, like giant robots and monsters and that, you know, and that they were being done by Marvel. It gave me hope that one day I would be able to do something like that. And so, you know, everything just sort of all fell together. So back in 2020, Matthew, it was a weird kind of loose idea where we just said, oh, cowboys and kaijus. And all of a sudden I started drawing sketches. And actually, one of my early sketches for B-Win, who's Hunter Bot B-Win, he's our protagonist, the bot with no name. I sat down and I had this, you know, in my mind, I saw this image of Clint Eastwood. But then it was Clint Eastwood. And then the next thing I saw was Jet Jaguar, who appeared in Godzilla and Megalon. I just loved the way his face looked. And then I said, oh man, Machine Man, Jack Kirby's Machine Man. And I just said, what would happen if I took all three of those individual characters and just blend them together and see what happens? And then I added dreadlocks to them because I have dreadlocks. And so B1 was born and Matthew saw it and he loved it. And then I just started, you know, we just started building from there.
Wow. Wow. So that's really, so you're an anime fan.
Oh, I love anime. I would say I'm hardcore. Like I was back in the '80s. I remember going to anime clubs. My kind of anime was, again, if you're talking old super robots like Mazinga Z, Get a Robo G. But then also, I mean, I stretch into other stuff. Like I love Crying Freeman. I love Akira. I love Demon City Shijuku. What else? God, I mean, I love Fist of the North Star. You're talking Gogo 13. I mean, I'm definitely in that whole realm of 70s, 80s anime. A little bit into the 90s a little bit. But I'm just a big fan of that old kind of anime art style of like very dark noir. I called it dark noir, crime noir kind of look where they used a lot of heavy blacks, a lot of heavy line work, or like there was a lot of like if they did technology, the technology was so like line work up on line work. You know, it was just insane. Like the way I would describe to the listeners, it's almost like if you ever saw Transformers, the movie 1984, 1985, when it came out, just the detailing of how they do mech or technology was so hyper, like every little line work. I love that stuff. So that's what I grew up with.
I got to ask you, because I dipped my toe into the anime water one time, and I always ask people into anime about the series that I read, and nobody seems to remember it. You're in the time period that I was reading it. Did you ever hear of a book called My the Psychic Girl?
Yes.
See, you're the first one I know that's actually read that book. I read that book to the end, and I loved it.
Yes.
That was a time period where I got into it, and I loved that one. There used to be an anime on Saturday morning on Sci-Fi channel.
Okay.
And I would watch that. I would record that and watch it, and I read that one. There was another series about, I think, a gentleman from Japan who was running for president in the United States.
Okay.
And he was in a Western-style restaurant, you know, and he was trying to show what a big guy he was. And so what he did was he ate not one but two steaks. And everybody else was floored. And I remember reading, and I talked with some of my friends. I said, he ate two steaks and that really impressed all of them, because I know some people who go down three or four steaks.
Oh, man.
And so I don't remember the name of that one.
Yeah. And it was an anime?
It was an anime.
Wow.
Black and white. And I read it. It was all in that same time period. My Psychic Girl.
Oh, yeah.
There was a couple of others.
I can go back to Cyborg 009. You know, Eight Man. I mean, these are, I'm just railing off. This is like, I'm talking about the stuff like Gigantor, which was Tessigen 28. I mean, that's, I'm old school. I just loved how the stories, they were these rich, deep stories. I always felt the music was very deep kind of music, sometimes jazzy kind of, you know, it was a lot of stuff that I just loved that time period of anime and even the mangas and stuff. So, yeah, it was definitely a great time to, you know, as somebody who was a budding artist, I was being inundated with that beautiful stuff. But then also, I had such a huge respect for the Western style of artwork as well. Like, I love the Western art coming from comic books during that time. And so I think that's why I'm so passionate now and doing what I'm doing with the artwork that I'm doing with Kaijus and Cowboys, is because I feel that in a certain degree that some of the newer generation have missed out a lot on that kind of, you know, that kind of art, the various art styles of that era of the 70s and 80s. And I'm definitely someone who's very impacted by it. And I feel that it's important to see those kind of styles. I mean, realistic style is great, but also there was almost like this sort of pseudo a non-realistic style too that was very prevalent in a lot of the comic books when I grew up. And they were all about pure escapism. And that's what Codgers and Cowboys is about, pure escapism.
It's really interesting because maybe you might be the one that might be good to define exactly what a kaiju is. I don't know if everybody knows that.
Well, it's funny because there's two. I posted something on my Facebook feed where somebody was mentioning a kaijin, because I was like, I hadn't heard that word before, and I kept seeing it pop up. And I guess I learned that a kaijin is technically somebody that is humanoid, almost human, who can transform into giant creatures. So that's one form, one way, I guess. I hope I'm getting it right. But then a kaiju is a mysterious, strange beast. And that could be, you know, it's weird because I guess Bigfoot could be a kaiju. But then we call them cryptids. See, it's weird because we'll call them cryptids. But I feel that it's a strange beast, a mysterious beast. So I guess Bigfoot could be a kaiju. But also, Daikaijus are technically what Godzilla is. So King Kong, Godzilla, the more larger creatures, gigantic creatures, those are called Daikaiju because of their size. Mm-hmm. So kaijus would probably be something that's a little bit smaller, but I guess they could be like an ogre or you know, some creature that can be a little bit more tall than a human being. But, you know, they would fit into that realm. So working on Kaijus and Cowboys, we have kaijus and we have Daikaijus. So we have creatures that are, you know, that could be roughly the size of Hunter Bot B. But then we have gigantic creatures that are like mountain size. You know, that could be Daikaiju. So that would be a Daikaiju.
Okay, because it's a fascinating story because I'm always interested. These post-apocalyptic things always intrigue me because, you know, basically you're starting from scratch. So you get to do world building, which, you know, so many comics today, there's it's all taking place in New York City, which should have been destroyed five times and over by now. So it's nice to see something that's in a different place. While I'm talking with you, I have to say one of the things about the Hunter Bot that impressed me was the look.
Yes.
He's got this hat with the great big
pointy
kind of jewelry thing on the top, which is kind of interesting. It's interesting because we don't really see the humans, even though they're a part of the story. When they land on this planet and things start to happen, there's no sign of any humans. Yes. It's only the robot, basically, and he comes marching out and. You talk about Clint Eastwood. He's got a very Western kind of feel to him.
Yes.
I was thinking he's a strong, silent type. He doesn't say much.
Well, maybe. Maybe. Well, see, that's the thing. Because Matthew's, of course, he's writing out this story. I know some of the stuff that he's doing. I feel that me and Matthew's relationship, we joke about it, but I feel like we're almost like Kirby and Stan Lee. You know, in a sense where, he's given me an overview of where he wants to take the story. But usually, he'll send me the script and then I'll look at the script. And then as I start, I do thumbnails. Usually what I do is I do thumbnails and stuff. And as I'm going through it, then I'll kind of build up on, like, you know, off of what he's already laid out. So it's a building process. It's almost like a house. You got the foundation and then you start packing up more stuff to eventually we have a home, you know. And so I'm always finding, like, he'll come with something. I'm going, whoa, wow, where'd that come from? And it's kind of, you know, kind of exciting because it's like, it's kind of new to me because I'm going, wow, man, whoa, I wasn't expecting that, you know? And I love that because I love that kind of energy. When I was doing work in animation and even in film production and also in advertising, I love the aspect of team. That's a big thing for me. I once told him, I said, Matthew, I said, one of the most amazing things that anyone can experience is when you're working with a team of people and everyone has brought their A game. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone, it's like a beautiful vehicle. Like you're in this car and you're like, everything works. When you're you're going on highway, you know, if there's enough fuel in there, you know, spark plugs, everything's sparkling, everything is just, and you're just driving, man, and you have no worries that anything's gonna break down. That's a wonderful feeling, and I love that kind of synergy and stuff like that. And I love the fact that Matthew's a lot different than me, where it's like that I'm into giant robots and kaijus. He is aware of them. He knows them to a certain degree, but he's not as hardcore as I am. And I don't even consider myself a hardcore. Like, there's people who are hardcore into kaijus and robots who can just destroy me in the stuff that they know. They're much more hardcore than I always consider that I'm someone who's more, it's an emotional kind of feeling. Like, when I watch these things as a kid, and even as I'm drawing it now, I'm having an emotional experience with this. You know what I mean? It's not like I'm sitting there and everything's textbook. It's more like when I was designing Bwin, and he's looking, you're talking about how his helmet, how he has his hat, and he has the big dagger thing sticking out, and he has a jewel in the center. That was all just me just sitting there inside my head going, you know, when I watched those shows, those anime shows back then, and how there was almost this outlandish nature to many of their character development, which I found so fascinating. Like the fact that his hat is like extremely long in the back. It's obnoxiously long. And I did that on purpose. You know, I was like, I want it to be long. I want it to be obnoxious because I wanted to hint at the influences of manga, that I'm somebody born in the West, you know, the United States, America. And yet I was influenced by the stuff from you know, that's coming from the East, from Japan, and from other Asian Asian countries abroad as well. I was heavily influenced by this stuff. The trick is that I'm not trying to emulate manga. So my characters aren't looking like manga characters. You know, I am an American artist, and I want to make sure that my artwork is a reflection of that American style of comic book, you know, kind of artwork. But the tropes that are in this, as I'm drawing them, there are definitely tropes that lend to the stuff that came out from, you know, from manga. And that's important. That's a very important thing.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, like, the cover, for example, of the issue zero, which I find interesting, because I, you know, he's the hunter bot is riding a dinosaur, and he's shooting at the kaiju.
Yes, the Steve.
As they go by. And I didn't realize that the guy in the bottom left is going to play an important role as we move forward. But I really like that. I thought, as a you know, as a guy who was, you know, when I was a young boy and stuff, dinosaurs were everything.
Yes.
You know, and so when I saw this guy riding, you know, not only is he shooting at these guys, but he's actually riding one of them. I thought that was so cool. That was it was kind of image that draws me into the book. And so I immediately, and I've read the three issues that you made available to me, which I really enjoyed. It's an interesting thing because it's visually, the visual storytelling is really strong. It's not, you don't get a lot of those. Meanwhile, it's such and such and such.
Yeah, exactly.
And all the, you know, one thing that drives me nuts is I turn a comic page and all I see is text.
Yeah.
This gray text going on and on. What I usually do, I change the page. I go right past it. And I don't bother because, you know, I figure it'll all be explained later on, I'm sure. So yours does not do that. Yours is, your book is very visually oriented, which I really like. There's some dialogue, along the way, particularly when the there's a robot that ends up helping the hunter bot.
Yes.
And I enjoyed the whole process of seeing him get involved with the hunter robot, and his function is like he's almost like Watson is in Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, well, that character right there, and I'm not afraid to mention him and stuff by now. His name is Doc, and I just to go back a little bit where you were saying how like the sense of the visual, the visual like looking at the pages and stuff like that. That's all on purpose, because when you read a lot of the Bronze Age books, especially from the 70s into the 80s, and you really look at those books, there was a lot of visual information that those artists would put in there. I mean, they would draw things that by today's standard, you don't see a lot of people do. Like, I remember looking at, you know, say, I'll say for, you know, Marvel, I remember looking at an Avengers book. I can't think of the artist who drew it, but they showed Thor at the Avengers mansion, mm-hmm. and he's sitting down and he's reading a newspaper, you know, and he's having a coffee, and Jarvis, the butler, is bringing him a cup of, you know, some tea or coffee or whatever. He's bringing him the coffee or whatever. And I was like, I sat there and I thought about that. And it's like, that's the stuff that I grew up with, where it was the little nuances, the little in-between stuff, where like, it wasn't just a big battle scene, but it was those moments where you saw, they took the time to illustrate that Thor is sitting down in his full costume, reading a newspaper, waiting for some calamity to happen, you know? And then same thing like the X-Men. I remember the biggest moments for me in the X-Men was the fact of, you know, Nightcrawler, Kurt Wagner, and Logan Wolverine sitting in the X-Men kitchen, and they're chatting over a brew. You know, it was just things like that where it was like, wow, this is the little nuances where they were sitting there and draw those little scenes in it. That was so important, instead of like just skipping over it, where it's like, okay, boom, 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 you know, the characters run to the next mission, and then it's just these big action scenes and pinups and stuff like that. You know, I love sequential artwork and definitely working, doing storyboards and stuff like that. It's taught me that sometimes, you know, when we're doing this, we need to somehow pull people into these universes that we're developing with the comic. Mm-hmm. So I want you to be able to look at this comic book and almost as if you're watching on TV. Mm-hmm. So we see those little nuances, like a character's, mm-hmm. you know, flaying about, or a character's running around, or it's what's happening to the character in the background, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of Batman the Animated Series.
Yes, yes.
When they went over from the Fox network to the WB, mm-hmm. they brought in Batgirl, and they had Batgirl and Nightwing and Robin mm-hmm. all there. And the one thing they did was they made it so that Batman rarely spoke.
Yes.
When he spoke, it was for a good reason, and in many episodes, he hardly said a thing.
Yes.
Which is a shame, because Kevin Conroy was terrific. Oh, to this man. Day, I read a Batman comic, I hear his voice when Batman speaks.
I think I have the book from the book by, who is it, Paul Denny's? Paul Denny's book. I think it's on his, Bruce Timm and Paul Denny. They did a book on that series, and I have it somewhere. It's amazing. You open it up and it's like all the stuff, like the storyboards, everything laid out. Mm-hmm. Amazing stuff to look at. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
See, I think sometimes it's, especially if you're doing a comic, the visuals are really critical. You know, they always say the old standard that if you see a cover will sell a book, mm-hmm. but it's a story that makes you come back and want more.
Well, I don't know if you noticed, but one of the things about our covers is that another thing from the Bronze Age is that if you look at the old school comic books from the 70s, maybe even earlier than that too, but say from the 70s to the 80s, because that's when I was around. Usually the covers were a preview, a prelude to what was going to happen inside. And another thing that we do. One of the mandates that we have for our covers is that the covers have to represent almost like a early warning, of what's actually happening on inside the story.
Hmm.
So that's a very important thing too, as well.
Cause you know, it used to drive me crazy from that era was that the cover would be the last panel in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that used to drive me crazy. I used to hate that because, you know, I'd work hard just to get to where I started. And I never liked that. But
well, when did you start comics? Like, when did you?
Oh, really? I've been reading since I was, I'm an old guy. I tell you, I was
nice.
I was born in the 50s, and nice. When I was about 10, I found a Batman comic in the cellar of the house.
Oh, nice.
And as Frank Miller described that, I opened the book and I fell in.
Wow.
I was in Batman's in England, and he's built this glider wing thing that he wears on his back, and he's gliding around this castle in England so he can patrol and keep it safe. Nice. And I was so floored. Oh. I had never seen anything like that. And to this day, Batman's my guy. And I just, that I'll never forget it. It was that description when I read Frank Miller's description of how he got into it. He was in a grocery store or a pharmacy, and he mm-hmm. went in. There was a comic. And he picked it up and he started to read it, and he described it that he fell in, and that was exactly my experience. I it's still with yours too. You know, yeah. I love a book that pulls me in and takes me out of where I am and into that universe.
If I recall those comic books back then, and I'm thinking like maybe the 50s into 60s, they were thicker books, weren't they? They had a thicker paper or something like that. The quality was a little thicker.
Well, not only that, when I read somebody got a Batman comic from the 40s, mm-hmm. and he let me read it. And believe me, I was so carefully turning the pages because, wow, that's an old comic.
Yeah.
The thing that I was so impressed about was that there were four stories in the comic, four complete stories in there.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, because today you buy a comic, you just getting a chapter out of a story.
Exactly.
But I loved that whole business. When I read those stories and I was just like, wow, I said, I love that. I love those kinds of things. So yours is, and that of course was very visually busy too, because I just think you have to, in order to attract people. And I tell you, you put a lot of thought into the artwork and stuff. I love it.
Thank you. I mean, one of the things about it was I sat down with Matthew and I said, Matthew, I said, well, first we talked, we had very realistic talks. I said, Matthew, I said, how many issues do you think you can do? And he said, well, I think I could do 12. And I said, okay, I haven't heard people talk about 12 issues since, boy, you're talking like, yeah, Crisis on Infinite Earth or what was it, Secret Wars? So you're saying, okay. I said, all right, 12. All right, cool. You can tell a story. And he said, yeah, I can tell this story in 12. I said, okay, cool. And then one of the major things for me was I said, okay, now, as somebody who's worked professionally in the field, I said, we have to make sure that our production schedule is a solid production schedule, because I feel like that's where a lot of people stumble, especially independents stumble with a lot of these projects. Because there's no real structure when it comes to production. Mm-hmm. You know, people mm-hmm. don't really think about it. They kind of go, mm-hmm. well, they think of an idea, then they go, oh my God, I got a concept. And then they get all fanatic, and then they just start throwing stuff down and whatever. And then mm-hmm. all of a sudden they don't have a solid deadline, and things mm-hmm. start getting me. And I said, one of the things about it, I said, let's start working. So we started working on our series much, much earlier. Like I just wrapped up issue 6, mm-hmm. and we're just now, issue 3 is coming out on, you know, well, we're going to have the campaign for issue 3 on Monday. Mm-hmm. So, you know what I mean? So I was making sure, I was like, we have to make sure that we're going to have books, that we're not going to run into any issues. When we do our campaigns, we can immediately be able to do fulfillment and get those books out to people, which we've been holding true. And it makes me so happy to see the people that are posting. Oh, that's great. The fact that they're like, hey, we just got the books. They came in. They look great. That kind of thing. So it's like, mm-hmm. I tell people, I'm like, you have to have a structure when it comes to these things. Treat it like a film. What do you think movies, when we do movies, they don't just fly off or whatever. They sit there and they say, okay, this is our production schedule. This is what we got to adhere to. Now, there may be some little, you know, leeway here and there because of whatever. Somebody may get sick or whatever, such and such. But you don't want it to the point where it's detrimental to the actual mm-hmm. process of development. You mm-hmm. just don't want anything to affect that because you're on a schedule. And so we've been able to hold true to that. And each time we're finessing it even more. We're always finding ways to make it much more streamlined, much more efficient. That's a big thing for me, making sure things are more efficient so that we can still keep the quality of the comic and not lose that, but then mm-hmm. also be able to ensure that we get it out, the product out to the folks to
read. You remind me of something. Just this week, I got in the mail a book that I paid for on Kickstarter 5 years ago.
Oh.
I thought I'd kind of given up that I'd ever see it, but it just came in the mail. And I wrote to the guy and I said, oh my gosh, I really enjoyed it. You know, I know the indie comics, it's hard and it's expensive to do this on your own. But I just want to let you know I liked it, and I appreciate getting it, and I'm so glad you followed through, because there are several Kickstarters that I have followed I've never seen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, look, I think the thing about it is that let's all be honest, and I think that now you're starting to see people starting to understand, but let's be honest. doing comic books is a business.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's much fun. It's fun to create these characters. It's fun to create these stories and all this. I get it, man. But it's a business. It's always been a business. And so if you walk into it with that mindset that it's a business, I think you'll do a lot better. Now, I'm not saying you have to be rigid. Don't you know, you're still supposed to have fun. Like, I'm having fun. This is fun. You know, even when I'm sitting there in the ink and whatever, this is fun. The most fun is when it's actually in the hands of people. That's the joy I get when it's like you do all this work and then finally it's in the hands of people and you just sit back and kind of go, okay, all right, now next on to the next thing. But, you know, but I want people to understand that this is hard work,
mm-hmm.
and you have to approach it from a sense of seriousness when you do these things, because there's no reason for a person like yourself, a reader, to be waiting 5 years for a book. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about trying to compete against someone, the mainstream comics, or even some of the mid mainstream guys out there, mm-hmm. then we got to look at this from an eye point saying, okay, look, at least, you know, hey, if we can at least build up a reputation of getting the books out on a certain amount of time and different quality, then that's going to amount to something. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's the thing that I try to tell people. I'm like, the only kind of equity that we're working with now is our reputation. We know many of us are, you know, we're working with, you know, we're paying our bills and stuff like that. We don't have the money for big marketing campaigns and all that stuff. So the only thing that we have as pure equity is our reputation. And so you don't want to have to chip that reputation away. You don't want to have it like people saying, well, you know, the book got shipped to me and it was crumbled up because the packaging was horrible, which mm-hmm. I'm sure you got horror stories. I know I got horror stories of stuff like that. And so, you know, you don't want stuff like that to happen. You don't want to have stuff where the book is late 5, you know, God, I couldn't even imagine 10 years, you know, 3. Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine a year late. But, you know, you don't want to have that stuff because it chips away at your reputation. And eventually it comes to a point where people just go, hey, fine, you may be a great, great artist or a great writer, but sorry, I don't want to buy your stuff anymore and they start checking off their boxes, you mm-hmm. know, and you just don't want to be in that situation. So
that's what I call the Janet Jackson rule. What have you done for me lately?
Exactly.
Of stuff.
Exactly.
And people, but I actually am an editor for an indie comic.
Oh, there you go.
And I can relate to all the stuff that you're talking about because mm-hmm. my roommate is the creator and the writer of the book, and I'm the editor. And what he would do is he would feed me stuff to edit as I would lay out the script for the artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I would give him feedback on stuff like that. And so there were times when he said, I want this to be really, really funny. And one time I said, well, it's not really funny. I said, you need to go back and make it funnier. And so he used me like as a sounding board. And one of the things that I think, and this is something particularly because when you're doing creative stuff like what you're doing,
yes,
feedback is so vital because yes. you get so little of it while you're making it.
Yes, yes.
You don't know until the book comes out and people actually see it.
Yes.
But yeah, I'll tell you a real quick story. I interviewed Scott Snyder.
Oh, there you go.
Wrote Batman. He was just coming on to Batman. I'll tell you how long ago this was. And I talked to him at Baltimore Comic Con. I said, I'd really like to interview you. I'm a big Batman fan. And I talked and I had done all my homework and stuff like that. And of course, I tend to be positive about stuff. And by the time we got to the end of it, he said to me, I appreciate all the good conversation we had. I'm very nervous about the Batman book that's coming out. And I said, well, what's making you nervous? He said, the orders are so high. I said, why does that make you nervous? He said, I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint people.
Yeah.
I said, no. I said, don't look at it that way. The reason why the orders are so high is that we want to see the stories you're going to tell. And so he asked me what I did, and I did this for a couple of years. He asked me every time a Batman book that he wrote came out, he wanted me to send him an email to his private email, which I never told anybody else about.
Mm-hmm.
And I would tell him what I thought of the current issue that just came out. And I did that. He's doing Batman. And I saw him again in Baltimore, and I looked at him. And I said, "Oh, there you are." And I said, "You know, I'm having real trouble writing you emails. I said, I'm running out of words, like fantastic and tremendous and wonderful." And he says to me, "Well, I'm not having any trouble reading your emails." He goes, "And you know, I don't do that anymore because he's not on Batman anymore." But I just, it was kind of fun because, you know, as creators, if they're looking for input and stuff like that, I'm always willing to tell them the honest truth of what I think and stuff. So with that, I did that with him. And I try in this podcast really to let people know about quality stuff that they may not know about.
Yes.
And that's kind of what this is all about. Somebody's been doing it for like 12 years now.
Oh,
and
wow.
I always wonder when I see something that attracts my interest, and I kind of think people should know about it. That's like what I'm doing with your book.
Well,
I do have a question. Let me run a real quick question and go to you. And I'm always interested in why things are the way they are. When you do the books, you have just like it's what was the name of the there was a Superman alike where they used to put it was printed so that the paper looks like it was old paper.
Yes, yeah.
And I noticed you have some of that. You have like the, and I'm just curious, is that obviously that's a conscious choice. Are you trying to elicit that kind of response?
Oh, look at you. Look at you. Yeah, you're catching all those nuances. Yes, of course. Yeah. But see, that's digital. See, it's funny because I'm still a traditional artist. Mm-hmm. So that means that I draw on, you know, comic book board. And all my line art, the artwork and stuff is on comic book board. But, you know, I'm also someone who's you know, little schooled in digital. So I scan my work into the computer and I work in Photoshop. And, you know, bingo bango, they have all these wonderful different layered files that you can lay things on and give these backgrounds, which is great. I mean, like I did old paper. You know, that's what I was looking for. So they have these things. So those are great tools to use to sort of help enhance the artwork. You know, ideally, I mean, I'm an old school artist where I still have like screen tone, you know, that occasionally, you know, I got some pieces where I have screen tone on. Screen tone is one of those kind of things where it's very time consuming. You know, I break out my X-Acto knife and you got to sit there and labor over it. But it looks amazing once you lay it onto the original artwork. But one of the things I wanted to bring up about like with artwork for me is that I'm a big fan of the journey. And the journey is with artwork as an artist is that I love the process of seeing an artist as they go through their transitional art style or as their art style, not too major art style change, but you could just see the sort of story of where their art has come from point A to point whatever, like point D or whatever, you know, and I think that's one of the things when I look at the pages of what I'm doing with Cottages and Cowboys, I kind of want readers to see that kind of transitional change with my artwork as it goes along from issue, because you got to read issue zero, but then seeing it even up to now, like when I'm on issue six, where I feel the artwork looks a lot more different, like I'm getting more relaxed with this world and with these characters and stuff like that. Because I feel like that's a necessary thing too, because I've gotten into a lot of conversation with new artists, and it seems like this huge weight that they have on them to try to do perfection. You know, they go, I gotta do the perfect image and whatever. And they're grasping with this and stuff. And I'm sitting there and I go, well, look, I said, if you're trying to create perfection, then that means that once you do this supposed perfection, when you put this artwork out, then that means that you can go, where else are you going to go with that? You know, eventually people are going to look at you and they're going to be like, well, you know, it'd be almost like you think of Mike Mignola, where he started off to where he landed with Hellboy. If anybody's seen his old work, it looks nothing like his Hellboy stuff. You can see, so it's like he has a story. Like if you look back, you go, wow, look at that. Look at that journey that he went through. I want to be able to have a journey. I don't want to be able to have one point and then be like, well, see, there you go, that's my art style, that's all I got. And then that's it, because eventually people look at that and they go, yeah, you know, we've already seen what you can do, let's look at the next shiny thing that pops up. You know, and that's what people have to be careful, because this is all about that continuous growth. You know, I hopefully when I, you know, by the point when I reach issue 12, my artwork is going to look so a little bit more different than how it looks from issue 0.
Well, the more you do it, the better you get at it.
Exactly. You become more relaxed with the characters. Because I could tell, even when I first started out, even like when you brought up that whole thing, like that issue 1 cover, it's kind of funny because I never noticed that. But, you know, that character that you assumed was Doc, that's not Doc.
Oh, it's not?
No, that was just a character I just drew. It was just, you know, I just wanted to draw a bunch of people being chased down. But the character Doc, when I designed him, originally, he didn't even look like that. He looked like this big, clunky machine. And then Matthew was like, well, he's like, well, I don't know, Frank. He's like, maybe we should do a kid. And I said, a kid? I said, I don't know, man. I said, I see somebody like, I said, Matthew, I said, did you ever see Tombstone? He said, yeah. I said, yeah. I said, well, I'm thinking of Val Kilmer, a doc. And so he said, okay. So then during that time, which was really weird, my wife was really into Star. She's big, hardcore Star Wars fan. I'm more of a Star Trek person. I grew up with Star Trek, but I always admired Star Wars. I saw, you know, I appreciate Star Wars for what it was. But, you know, when I was with her, we sat back and we started catching up on Star Wars stuff. And I watched The Clone Wars. And that was probably the first time, which is bizarre, because as a person who loved robots, I remember having R2-D2. And I remember having C-3PO as you know, I remember having an R2-D2 remote control robot as a kid. And I just got him because he's a robot. I was just like, oh, yeah, so he's a robot. I got to get him. But I never really understood how, like, capable R2-D2 is. I mean, R2-D2 is really amazing. And after watching the stuff that was in that show, I was like, okay, all right, I got it. I know how I'm going to do Doc. And so Doc is like a fusion of, well, Doc from Doc Holliday, but also a little bit of R2-D2 and a little bit of Herbie the Robot from Fantastic Four. In which I wanted to make a character who wasn't just going to be this kind of pushover kind of character, but capable. You know, he's a medic, but I wanted to make it where he has elongated arms and like he knows how to use his body. So like he's not as a fighter in the sense of like B-Win, Hunter Bot B-Win, but if he had to, he could throw down a little bit. You know, I don't know how long the question would be, how long could he last against a compatriot, somebody going up against him? I don't know. That would be the question, depending on how the story is. But, you know, I would definitely show him in a situation where he could give as much as he can take. And I love characters like that. Like, I love, my favorite character is Ben Grimm the Thing. You know, I always felt that Ben Grimm was a classic kind of like, you know, somebody who was just fighting with the heart. You know, I don't know if you remember that famous the book when Marvel 2 and 1 when the champion comes to Earth and he fights Ben Grimm and a bunch of other super strong characters from the MCU. And Ben Grimm is the only person who actually like he goes up and battles them, boxes them in the ring, and then the champion stops the fight because he goes, he's like, I would have to kill you. And he said, that's not my point. I don't want to kill you. You know, he said, because you have so much heart. And he just leaves. And then Ben Grimm just, he's just beaten down. He just falls to the ground. But he still talks, you know, his, you know, his Ben Grimm smack or whatever. And it's beautiful. It's like, it tells that character right there. Like, he had the heart. He's like, he has that heart. Like, you know, I will throw down with you, you know, no matter what. Even if you could kill me, I still would go after you. And I love that kind of, those kind of characters. The underdog kind of characters. And so that's how I see B-Win in that same kind of way. And I also see Doc in that way as well.
Well, a lot of this enthusiasm, believe me, it comes through in Kaijus and Cowboys. And again, the campaign starts August 21st.
Yes.
Do you know when it's going to end? When does it end?
Oh, boy. I think usually 30 days.
Yeah, 30 days. Because we're recording this a little ahead of time, and awesome. So there's going to be And do you remember how much you're asking for this time?
This time around, we're going to go for $3,000.
$3,000. Okay, that's very reachable.
Yeah,
I think that'll be great. So I think you're very. I think it'll be really successful. I think this has an animated feature in its future. I just think that this could be a very easily be a cartoon.
I think that the pathway that I would love to follow if I was going to push my dream would be the same pathway like the Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird. where they first had toys. Mm-hmm. I say that the toys first, if we could get toys, and then somebody comes along and says animated. I think the toy. I would love to have the figures first, and then come because then after that, then once people get the figures and they go, oh, okay, you know, whatever, and build from there. But I feel like we're walking in the same pathway that Kevin Eastman and Pierre Larry did, you know, and many others, not just them. I mean, it was just other amazing indie creators back in that time that created incredible stuff that still has longevity to today. I mean, man, Cerebus, Dave Sim. Mm-hmm. Jeez, if we could get the 300 issues, oh.
Well, I think Kaijus and Cowboys is very much, it's going to be very successful and very much along those lines. And I think what's going to happen is I think this will be a big success. And I think you're already, as you were telling, you're already down to issue 6. Yes. And so you're going, I love it when I hear a creator who works that far ahead, because I know we're going to see good things coming.
Oh, Wayne, thank you. Thank you so much.
And Frank, it's so great to talk with you. We have to talk again.
Yes, I think, because
there's a lot of things that we could still cover that we could do. But it's so good, and much success with this. I'm just sure that you're going to have a lot of success with this. Oh. And in the future, let's talk again when you've got I'm sure this will be a success. Maybe we move on to the next thing. Now, before we go, though, I want to make sure to tell people how to follow you guys online on social media.
Well, you can follow me on, I don't know if we're still calling it Twitter.
X now. I think X it's
now.
X.
So you can follow me on X. I'm also on TikTok. I'm also on Facebook, and I'm also on Instagram, and also Threads. And it's just Frankie B. Washington for me. And then also Codgers and Cowboys has a page on Twitter. And Matthew, I believe, is on Twitter. Excuse me. X is on X. And then I think he's also on Blue Sky.
I haven't gotten on there yet. I know.
Yeah. He's on there. So he's kind of, he's our eyes on there. So he just got on there and stuff, and he's sort of scoping it out and to see how that whole thing is. So yeah. So he's on Blue Sky. So, I mean, pretty much, just Frankie B. Washington, and, I'll pop up.
but I'm sure it's Kaijus and Cowboys are going to be a big success. This is issue 3, but you can catch up on there as well. So just keep up the wonderful stuff, Frankie. It's great talking with you.
Oh, most definitely. And thank you so much, Wayne, for having me on. Again, it's individuals like yourself that are shedding a light on individuals like us who are indie creators. We are on the left side of the field, folks. And we need that light to shine on us, so you guys can see all the great stuff we're doing. So thank you so much, Wayne, and individuals like yourself who are out here fighting the fight to get us out there into the light.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.
Hal Jordan of Earth, Green Lantern of Sector 2814. The Viceroy of Demrak 7 claims that when we assigned you to police crucial peace negotiations, you punched him in the face. Is this true?
No, sir. I punched the Viceroy in the stomach. Then I headbutted him in the face. Sir.